Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening, and welcome to the Green Egg Radio Hour. I'm Ariel Montserrat.
And I'm Sylvie Saloo. Our special guests tonight are Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller. After 5 years of college teaching, we're co for public radio, and we're twice recipients of the National Endowment for the Arts Writing Fellowship. They've raised two kids in the back of a Dodge van in a Neil Pagan circle, voted founders of Milwaukee's Theater X, and in 1974 formed the Independent Eye, which they continue to direct. They have played over 3,000 performances in 35 states for the widest array of audiences. They have established resident theaters in Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and now work out of their studio in Sebastopol, California. They have collaborated in writing more than 60 produced plays for their own ensembles and for theaters across country, including off-Broadway productions of Full Hookup and Media Sacrament, have produced them the couple most likely to have stepped out of a Robert Heinlein novel.
For the past 5 years, their work has focused on puppetry for adults with stagings of Shakespeare's The Tempest and their own adaptations of Frankenstein and Descent of the Goddess Inanna. Now they're about to open a new show, Gifts, designed for touring as house concerts. A year ago, they published a memoir, Co-Creation, 50 Years in the Making, about their 5 decades as mates and artistic collaborators, and now they've launched another venture, writing prose fiction. Their first novel, Realists, has just become available as an ebook. And I started reading it, haven't finished it, but I've started reading it. The writing is absolutely wonderful, and it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. And I've known Elizabeth and Conrad for almost 15 years, I guess, and I remember, my most salient memory is about 12 years ago when I went to their 40th wedding anniversary party, which was a wonderful party, and they had displayed their wedding pictures, and they both of them, you know, Elizabeth had on like little white gloves and a white dress, and they both looked like they're about 19 and, you know, kids.
That was about right.
It was a crew cut and the whole thing, you know. Yeah, 1961. And then you turn the page, and it has a picture of them at their 10th wedding anniversary party, and they're both, what, at 11 or something, and nude with body paint all over and just
that was
like,
yeah, that was our hand fast, the hand fasting that we did up at Starwood.
Oh, that was it. Okay. It was just a wonderful, wonderful. I just loved it. I always remembered that.
Well, we did the corporate wedding because we were kids, and what could we do? I mean, the folks were paying for it, and there you go. Besides, we didn't know about alternatives, and then when we started to know about it, we said, hey, now that we know what we're doing, let's do this again.
Yeah,
nudity would have been a little strange with about 100 people in business suits. You know, it would stand out, I think, somehow.
Yes. So now, why spend 50 years in theater and then suddenly start writing fiction?
Well, I ask myself that question daily. But actually, we've always been interested in taking a story and finding what the ideal form for it is, or the right medium, and sometimes we've adapted things from the stage to radio drama, or vice versa, or rarely into prose, but or from a regular play into something for puppets, and there's something that happens every time you do that. It's the same story, but you're asking different questions.
I think the biggest slippery slope for that, frankly, was writing the memoir, which which we did together in a very strange way. We would take the same scrapbooks and letters and clippings and diaries and all that kind of thing, and we divided our 50 years up into a bunch of chapters. And so we would each take the same source material, and he'd sit over on his computer, and he'd write the story of those years without showing me. And I would sit over on my computer, and I would write the story of those years without showing him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we would get to the end of that chapter, we would trade papers, so to speak. And that way get, you know, what you don't get when you work agree to work it all out together.
Right.
And then we figured out how to make that be an interesting narrative. And it really is. We've done an awful lot of live readings of it, and it really does read wonderfully out loud. It's not fiction, but it's a different way of telling the story, obviously, than telling it on the stage. And we suddenly discovered, well, you know, we can do this.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then the next stage was actually the next thing was Realists, because we had developed it as a play. At a residency at a college in Pennsylvania, they brought us in, said, work with the students, develop a play. And we did a lot of improvisation, and then I'd sit up all night scripting a scene, and we'd start rehearsing that scene while improvising the next thing and so on, and came up with what I think was a really wonderful piece. But if you're developing a piece with 15 characters in today's theater,
forget it.
You'd better have a pretty heavy reputation. You ain't going to get
a lot of money.
It's just too expensive. And so it hung around for a while, and I said, well, what if we do this in a different way?
And you go, you know, you create these characters, but once you've got them on their feet, they don't belong to you anymore. They're their own critters, and when you're not working with them, you start to feel lonesome for them. I just loved so many of those people from that play, not the actors but the characters, and it just felt good to say, oh, come on, let's party, let's do this again.
That's wonderful.
So now it's making the usual rounds of looking for print publication, but in the meantime, we put it up for ebooks, and I've gotten some really nice response from it. In the meantime, we're working almost done with our second novel, and halfway through the first draft of the third one. So,
wow, you people have been really producing.
It's a bit maniacal, yeah.
Well, we decided back a couple of years ago that we had a good long run of doing stage productions that would take a year of our lives to put together.
Wow.
And invest all the love and all the care and all the artistry that we have and not have much else of a life for about a year, and then we rehearse it, and then people see it not in huge quantities for about 3 weeks, and then it all goes into bins in storage, and suddenly we thought, all right, that's good memories. That's interesting stuff in the bins, and I'm glad we did that, but let's not do that anymore. And when we put that large scale, and, you know, when we say large scale, we're talking about some really astonishing, beautiful stuff with very complex visual elements and music and all the rest of it. But then now what? And so then we started, that then took us into the memoir, and that took us into the readings, and that took us into saying, well, these readings are really cool. We get a lot of hot energy going in these living rooms. Let's see if we can do a play that way. And so that was the next thing, and that's about to open. It was supposed to open earlier, but they opened Conrad instead.
I had surgery in the meantime. And found some fascinating things to put into the play. No, actually, but we'll be then developing that for touring and focusing primarily on house concerts and very intimate venues.
But when you've been accustomed to having the faucet turned on with that much water pressure in there, and then you just say, okay, well, we're going to turn off that major faucet and open a whole lot of others, you find, my God, it just starts squirting all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hence three novels and a new play and the memoir. And it's taken a little getting used to. It's a different horse to ride.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, people do seem to reinvent themselves, you know, in later life a lot of times. They take up a second career or something, and so...
Well, you know, talk to a snake. Snake does it all the time. Sheds its skin, starts over.
Right. That's true. Yeah. And that's perfectly natural. That's how it works.
Yeah. Well, are you two part of any spiritual group? And if so, how does that affect your artistic work?
Well, we've had different manifestations of that depending on where and when you're talking about. But what we have going on right now is, to me, just tremendously satisfying. We have a very good full moon circle, and not all of us...
Very small, about 8 people.
Yeah. Not all of us come from the same exact tradition, but everybody's very tolerant of the form for whatever. And we're all grown-ups, and we've all been around the block in terms of raising energy a number of times. And it's just wonderful to have this community. And we raised some – we were having drought, and we raised a month worth of rain. And we had a friend who was having no luck getting pregnant, and she just had her baby 3 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And some healings, and, you know, we've had sufficient evidence to say we're not just playing pretend.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very eclectic group. It's a couple people from sort of a mountain fairy tradition and gardnerians and... Some of us old
Church of All Worlds
characters, and it's just a monthly thing, and it's a small thing. But at this stage, we really like that kind of intimacy of working, and also having a great supper afterwards.
Yes.
I don't know if it has any effect on the writing, except that when you have that continuing experience of putting yourself on a somewhat different plane and reaching blind into deep consciousness, well, that's what you have to do when you're writing, too. And so I think maybe there's a little more readiness to do that.
Well, I think there are themes that... we might be aware of, even if we weren't having any direct pagan contact, but there's certainly themes having to do with the evolution of a soul, of a connection to a larger entity, and that kind of constant search that people are going through, really... No matter what tradition they're a part of, unless they're part of a tradition that you found it all by the time you're 12, and then you can just go to sleep, you know.
Yeah, really.
But that would be very boring to me.
Yeah, really. So, do you want to tell us about your novel, Realists?
Yeah.
Yes, let's start with just the little basics there, that if you're looking for it online, it's Realists, R-E-A-L-I-S-T-S, and it's by Bishop and Fuller.
Yeah, you can find it on a website called smashwords.com for any e-reader. And you can read the first 3 chapters as a sampler on that. Go to Smashwords and search on Realists, Bishop and Fuller. And that will get there. Or if you have an Amazon Kindle, you can go to Amazon and do the same search and get that version. And it's like $4.99.
It's a book that basically falls into the first half and the second half. And the first half is in a world that unfortunately feels terribly familiar, that people have gotten so discouraged with the process of voting, they just don't bother.
Yeah.
And when,
well, 15% of us do.
Yeah. Well, in the novel, nobody was paying enough attention, and a bunch of really incompetent fascists get elected.
The Realist Party.
Yeah.
The Realist Party. Yeah.
And some of their biggest contributors are Big Pharma, and so they just carry the war on drugs one step further, and they say, Let's reformat this. What we're going to do, we're going to wipe out dreams, because dreams are naughty, and they scare children.
They're pornographic. They're a waste of time. They take you into, you know, other worlds, and clearly they're not real.
So, you know, it's the same mindset that says you can't use entheogens, okay?
Yeah.
You can't dream. And so to enforce this, there are drugs put in the drinking water, and you have to take a pee test once a month to show that you've got an adequate dosage of it. So, of course, a very substantial part of the population becomes clinically nuts because you have to dream.
But only 30%.
That's a small price to pay. So in the midst of a society like this, which is technologically a little in advance of our own, but not a whole lot, but, you know, follow the bouncing ball about the deterioration of any common sense, and there you go. Mm-hmm. And so a bunch of people are all, for differing reasons, they're all identified by Homeland Security, et cetera, as being a terrorist cell. And
it starts with the guy complaining about a phone bill that is...
you don't want to mess with a corporation like that.
And then everyone who has had any contact with him for the last 2 weeks, or tangential contact to somebody who has had contact with him, is identified as part of the terrorist cell.
So the feds are going to do a roundup, and they're going to, you know, capture all of them. But one of this number is a very advanced military physicist, and he's been studying magic, or the practical applications of the chakra system to warfare and stuff like that. And he has, unfortunately, suddenly realized that, wait a minute, there's something happening here in this no dream stuff that is just about to hit the fan. And what's going to happen is that all of these people who have been dream deprived and right on the edge of psychosis will develop the ability under sufficient stress to actually fragment consensual reality. Not that they go into, into a delusion. They actually literally bust reality. They hive off a plate of it, and now nobody can talk to each other.
If you put small groups of people into a confined space under high stress, then suddenly the occupants of a subway car getting off at Wall Street ready to go to their offices crawl out of the subway car as the cargo of a slave ship coming into with chains around their ankles and carrying their briefcases.
So this is how we get our little band of terrorists in the second half, instead of all lying dead at the bottom of the elevator shaft after the CIA cut the cables. Instead, they come to consciousness on a westbound Green Tortoise bus. Actually, we call it the Blue Terrapin. But it's the Green Tortoise, don't tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the whole second half of the novel is their attempt to avoid being slaughtered by the might of the U.S. military chasing them. And magic is very much a part of how they survive and what they do with themselves.
Mm-hmm. And it's very much really about the characters and about the bonds between the characters. I mean, it has a science fiction plot, obviously, but it's not... It's not hard science. It's an excuse to really look closely at how any group of very diverse individuals forms bonds and survives.
Mm-hmm.
I could read you a 4-minute excerpt if you'd like.
Oh yeah.
This is from late in the novel, and. They have taken refuge temporarily in the desert, in the Nevada desert, with an ex-lover of the old bus driver who's been driving the Blue Terrapin for 30-odd years. named Shadow, who is a sculptor. And they come, they're unannounced. And these are just sort of three connected excerpts. It's a longer chapter. He turned to the bus, waving them all to enter the rambling shanty. The rooms were rife with plants. She'd made soup for a dozen people. They didn't know how she had expected them, but she had places set, scattered through three adjoining rooms. A tray beside a ratty armchair, two places on a burled coffee table with camp stools, a peeling white kitchen table pulled up to a sofa. Oddly, it seemed as if no one lived in these rooms. Perhaps there was some hidden chamber through other passages where it would seem that, yes, this is where the heart is. At first, in the dim, fractured light, it seemed that the walls were laced with myriad dark vegetation. Then they saw the sculptures. Human and animal, figures the size of Barbie dolls, the faces of children, dwarves, soldiers, and laughing women, the screaming and the blind, apoplectic fathers and maddened artists, the snarling mouths of the losers and the dull plod of the conquistadors, a woman nursing, a tangle of lovers held in gigantic hands and woven into the orgy were grocers offering olives and grapes, a wall of the faces of mothers waiting for their sons. Formed of papier-mâché, deep amber sun, and the blackest black. All the figures were linked somehow by hands or legs or noggins conjoined, limbs branching out like the fingers of trees. They formed a spiral dance through the rooms, crossing the wall's broad flatness, then looping low behind an old sofa into a corner where suddenly they climbed upon one another like a tumble of beetles ascending some rich corruption. None were separate, all in a single dance. There was no attempt at gallery display, no lights to illumine the curvatures. It seemed to be some odd whim of shadows, like a priceless Rembrandt left lying against the dryer in the utility room, as meaningless as laundry. The passengers filtered through the rooms in silence. They were directed piecemeal to the places set with bowls of pungent soup. They sat and began to sip, glancing up from time to time at the dancing walls. And they actually, each one is seeing a different set of figures, depending on who they are. Two children in the group. "What is it?" Jesse whispered. "People," Loki replied. "Somebody sculpted them. It's all paper." But both children were more focused on their soup. "Too zingy," said Jesse. Smokey, the old bus driver, devoured his second helping of soup. Corn chowder, jalapenos, and cognac, he guessed, with maybe some lizard parts. He saw everyone staring at the walls. What the hell are they staring at? "Dreams," said Shadow. "I keep them all here, the ones that haven't been dreamed. I've just kept adding since 1992. Endangered species, you know. Yours have all been dreamed? You must have been living a pretty special life, or a very sad one, if you don't see my artwork there." Smokey didn't understand, nor would he pretend to. Shadow's magical stuff always rubbed him raw. He sat at the yellow formica table in a tiny kitchen alcove while she ushered the passengers to their bedding places. He stared at the barren walls. Shadow returned. She sat across from him in a high-backed wicker chair he didn't recall, the table he knew from repairing one of its heavy grooved legs. He wasn't a great carpenter, but once he fixed a piece of furniture, it might be dented and skewed, but it sure as hell didn't wobble. "You did a good job on that," Shadow said. "You should have let me paint it," Smokey replied. "I hate that mustard color." "You decided you didn't want to look at it anymore." "You decided you didn't want to look at me," he snapped. She smiled. They sat in silence. Smokey knew what was going to happen. He would hem and haw, then start talking, and when he began, he would tell her every wrinkle in his soul. He would talk till dawn, which they do, but they do a little bit more besides that. And then it comes up in the last paragraph. In other rooms, the passengers dreamed their undreamt dreams. Those dreams had been in exile, and now they moved in each person's streets, searching to get their bearings. There was a familiar doorway, and one dream hunkered there to catch the little boy on his way to bed. A shop advertised keys while you wait, and a phantom emerged with keys to every door of the labyrinth. A dream found a flute and began to play. A dream went naked to school. A dream found warm flesh and laughing eyes. On the walls, the statuary liquefied. The walls began to clear. So that's a little snippet.
That's wonderful, wonderful. It's interesting because, you know, I've been on your email list, your announcement list for I don't know, a number of times and throughout the years. And I always find it fascinating because your writing is just, this writing that I'm reading in Realists is so similar to how you announce things. And it's really beautiful, beautiful writing.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. so now, there's a print version. Is there a print version?
There's not a print
not
version.
Not yet. If somebody decides they want to publish it, then there will be. But the we've self-published four books in actual paper and covers.
Mm-hmm.
But we could do that because it's a niche market. They're plays. And then our memoir is something that we distribute ourselves and have no problem getting rid of. But fiction, that's something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's going to exist on a shelf someplace, it's going to have to be because a commercial house decides to publish it.
Yeah, if people want to, don't want to read it on their e-book or their or e-reader or their computer screen, why, they can print it out.
Mm-hmm.
For the computer.
But it's a long novel, so it'll take a lot of paper.
Small print.
Yeah. Well, that's why I got a Kindle, you know, because I was getting so many e-books for review, you know, for Green Egg.
Yeah.
And so it works real nicely on the Kindle. And so anyway, I highly recommend actually anything that Conrad and Elizabeth does. I've known you two for like almost 15 years, and
yeah.
The one thing I really missed that I always wanted to see was The Descent of Inanna. And I just want to ask you real quick, do you have any plans at all to do that anytime soon?
No, we do have a DVD of our production, though, that is available through our website. It's a fairly decent copy. I mean, it's not, the camera work is not professional level, but you can get a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. And the actress who performs the role of Inanna, this is with our signature large puppets, so you don't ever really see her face,
mm-hmm.
but you get a really good feeling of her. She's the one who just had the baby.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it has I think about 20 some puppets operated by five actors, and Elizabeth is playing a contemporary woman who has really had a serious breakdown, and her daughter ships her a copy of the Inanna poems, thinking she might enjoy them. But they start sort of infesting her dreams, and then she starts really connecting directly with that character in the process of all of the stages of it, and eventually into
so
the,
she
into
she
the
herself
the
makes the descent with Inanna and comes back up, you know, as you do. If you're going to recover from a suicide attempt, you better get to someplace different from where you were.
Mm-hmm.
And so she simply goes with it to the absolute bottom, and then comes back up with the resurrection.
But I think it occurs to me that we've always been interested in sort of multiple worlds of experience. In the case of the Inanna, we resisted just doing something that was a straight reproduction of the myth. And there had to be a contemporary element as well, the present-day world.
And that's woven in the sound score as well. I mean, the whole concept of the underworld and the process of the descent is very heavily accompanied. The music also contains the shrieking and the horns and the pounding wheels of the Philadelphia subway system.
Oh, my.
Well, you try to find what really sounds like hell. It's pretty easy to find these days.
Right. Well, you had theater of some kind in Philadelphia for quite a while, didn't you?
Yeah, for 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had regular theaters, bricks and mortar theaters, and run regular seasons and so on. But I would say that our heart has always been in touring and doing things for a very wide range of people. That's the way we started out after I left college teaching, and we started a theater ensemble in Milwaukee, and in part to get out of the Fine Arts Center where everybody came and had their seat and saw the six plays and so on and so forth. And then suddenly you're playing for a prison audience, or you're playing for a high school audience, or you're playing for a bunch of campus ministers, or, you know, every which thing, or a war rally. And that kind of spoiled us for the straight sit-down thing. I love to do something in a regular theater with all of the toys that you can play with, and all the lighting and everything and so on. It's a great way to exercise your craft if you know it, but there's always something lacking in that. And so every time we've gotten into a situation, which we did, we had a theater in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and another one in Philadelphia, one in Milwaukee, and when we moved west to California, we resolved never again, because our heart really is in doing something project by project that is absolutely compelling you to do it, and not just because, well, I need to do 4 things on this season to fill the subscriber roles.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And that's not easy. I mean,
back in the day, we would sometimes carry a production in our repertory for 5, 6, 7 years, which we could do because we weren't performing it for the same people over and over. We would take ourselves to the audience instead of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that feels, one of the things I like about that is that it feels very borderline illegal to me. I don't know why, but I've always enjoyed that feeling of being kind of just a little bit on the other side of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And there, and the development of feeling that way has had many, many viewpoints, but one of them actually was in, one of those epiphanies was in Tennessee. We were touring with 2 other people and with our 2 kids in the van, and we were all going all over the Southeast, and we had a gig in Knoxville, and we were staying, we got people always to put us up in, on their couches or floors or whatever, and we were getting ready to do Shakespeare's Macbeth with puppets and 3 people, and we had to all of us learn the entire play. Any one of the 4 of us had to be, the 3 actors and the director, had to be able to recite the entire play from beginning to end.
Wow.
And because we didn't know how we were going to divide the lines up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we were learning it, and we had developed this handy-dandy way of doing that, that we would sit and we would chant it in unison, and one person would hold the book to keep us in case when we went astray or lost it or whatever, and we would take turns as to who held the book. But we would chant in unison. So we're sitting very hungover after the previous night's celebrations in this kitchen in Knoxville, chanting, and we all got the same thought at the same time, and it just raised the hair on the backs of our necks, realizing, oh, this is the roots of our profession. This is how it used to be done.
This is the way they did it 3,000 years ago.
Oh, my heavens. Wow.
Yeah.
You had the master who knew it and the apprentices who learned it.
Yeah.
And that feeling of being part of something that has been part of the human story since time out of mind made things different.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And I did not know that that's how it was done. And it does, I can see where it has a, there's a sense of passing the torch on, you know, to the next generation. Yeah. Yeah. Ah, wonderful.
And so that's how we, you know, we crossed that line when writing came along. And that's how come we have the stories about the goddess Inanna, because the Sumerians were the first one to invent writing that could be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell about your experience with the tablet.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, they inscribed things on with a stylus in wet clay and then dried it.
If you've seen those in museums, it's impossible to even figure out how anyone could see that it was writing, let alone that they were able to interpret it. Because
Conrad said it looks like a chicken doing a hat dance on a mud flat, you know.
Yeah.
So it did get translated with some wonderful breaks with great scholars. But the language doesn't exist anymore, spoken. Only the way it's been, you know. And when we had done our Medea, we started the sound score with, we got a classics prof with a really good voice to recite the opening of Euripides' Medea in ancient Greek. And it was, oh, God, that was magical. And I put a big archaic flute behind it, and it was, boy, it was a way to go. Said, oh, we will? All right, let's do that with Inanna. Let's use the opening lines of the descent. But what does it sound like? We don't know. So there were three universities who collaborated in making this translation possible, and one of them was the University of Pennsylvania. So,
in Philadelphia.
So I called and I said, is there anybody there who could give me a clue, or better yet, read out loud to me any of the text of the Descent of the Goddess Inanna? And sure enough, they had an elderly retired professor of Swedish descent who had been one of the original team, and he was so enchanted that anybody cared about this.
Yeah,
and I went over there with my little recording device, and he said, well, you know, I'll be glad to do this, but, you know, it will have a Swedish accent. I said, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be able to tell. He said, we have a pretty good idea how the language would have sounded, close enough for government work, because there are languages that are directly descended from it. So anyway, he hauled off and gave me about 5 minutes worth of recording, which then Conrad memorized and did it in his own gorgeous voice.
Yeah.
But the man was so, he said, oh, this is, he said, here, if you've got time, come back here. Come back here. Don't tell anybody. Just come back here. And he took me back where they don't allow the public to go. And here were these walls of very strange file drawers. They're big, like 3 feet wide, maybe 6 inches high, and they go back 3-4 feet. They're great big rolling trays with fronts on them. And he hunted around for a while, and then he pulled one out, and he picked up a clay tablet from it. And he put it in my hand. And he said, now this is the text of the Descent of Inanna. This is what I just read. He said, it's not the original. This is a copy. It's maybe only 2,500 years old. But this is it. And I thought, oh, dear God, don't let me drop it. But the knowledge that what I was holding in my hand, 2,500 years ago, a human being held that in their hand and wrote these words on it.
When he said it was a copy, what he meant was that it was probably a clay tablet that was written as part of a school exercise
2,500 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Because everybody had to copy it from the master.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So,
well, I have a question that I'd like to ask you, too. You two have been married 51 years, which is a feat within itself.
Yeah.
You just don't say that to me anymore, you know. But I want to know, how do you guys work together, you know, being married so long? How do you do it?
Well, I suppose you could ask any one of my relatives who are all farmers, because they do exactly the same thing. it's a matter of getting on the tractor instead of sitting at the computer. I guess the book is a lot, the co-creation book is a lot about that, and trying to condense it, what would you say, Lynn?
Well, it depends on what part of those 51 years you're talking about, because we discovered that roughly every 7 years, everything in our life turns upside down and has to reformulate. It's like shaking a kaleidoscope, and then you get a new picture. But in the meantime, it's very confusing.
Yeah.
And so it depends on when in the distant past you're talking about. For a long time, what happened was that I never wrote things down on paper or on a computer. He would turn on a tape recorder and start interviewing me as a character without any preparation. And I would just kind of go into an altered state and say whatever seemed reasonable to say. And it would be recorded and then transcribed, and it would form part of the raw material for whatever we were writing. And then we would sometimes do that together. One of the most memorable scenes that we ever improvised together was a mother chewing out her teenage daughter who has just gotten caught with grass in a car crash. And so he was the teenage daughter and I was the mom. But it produced the scene. And now anymore, we tend to work more in tandem. There's a lot of arguing. You know, we're not the Bobbsey twins. We don't see things through the same set of glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it takes a whole night of tussling before it gets. We work, even though there's only two of us, we work on Quaker consensus, which we do know quite a bit about.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea isn't to just reduce it to whatever both people will put up with.
Mm-hmm.
It's finding what's at the heart of it that really both of us find to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that comes easily, and sometimes, man, it takes a lot of headaches and stomach aches.
Yeah, I think you don't. I would say, with fair candor, that we don't necessarily sit down together to talk about something feeling that this is going to be one of the most sweetest, gentlest, most lovable experiences of our life. We do that in other circumstances, and we do have some sweet, lovable experiences. But I think one of the things is that you develop over a span of time, you develop a faith that eventually you're going to come out with something that you both like,
mm-hmm.
that you both can really say, yeah, I buy that. Not just, okay, well, you can have your way this time and I'll get my way the next time or something like that. That way lies death. But it's a matter of having to listen very closely to, you know, okay, she's saying this is overwritten, but what does that mean? What is it that
mm-hmm.
is not? What are the options? Do we take out all the adjectives, or do we make all the rest of it equally overwritten, or you know, or exactly what? And the faith that you've done this many times before, and
mm-hmm.
you're both basically, you have different temperaments and different tastes, but you're both basically representative of the larger audience that you hope this is going to come up with, so you necessarily have to have a respect for
right.
what piece of idiot thing that person just said, you know.
And it's another thing that has happened that has changed is that now I actually can sit down at the keyboard and write stuff. I was very reluctant to ever do that, I think because I really felt that I whenever I did that, I was being completely fake. But we would get to a place where he'd say, I'm stuck on this. I'm just stuck. I don't know. I can't budget. I don't know what. Here, would you just sit down and write something, anything? Write whatever you feel like writing that goes in this place. And you don't have to pretend that we're going to use that. Just something to get me off the dime.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to, once I discovered I didn't have to be good, and that's one of the biggest things about writing, is you have to stop insisting that whatever you write to start with is supposed to be good.
Hmm.
You just write. You just write. And then you go back and you look at it. But you don't sit there criticizing over your own shoulder while you're doing the first draft.
I mean, our second novel is currently in its, I guess, sixth draft. You know, so there's a lot of electrons down the tubes. Used to be a lot of pieces of paper down the tubes. Now it's just electrons.
You're hearing about your creative process is just as interesting as watching you perform. It's it's quite something. So, go ahead, Sylvie.
Have something in common with a lot of other authors I know. You know, I've heard several authors talk about I got the entire thing written, and then I just deleted it and started over.
Yeah.
You know, and not
wow.
You know, with the not criticizing yourself and just talk, you know, just write and let it flow.
A friend of ours, we did not somebody who was a close friend, but I actually performed the role that was her in a play called Day Trips. Would do a lot of she was Jo Carson, and if you can get a hold of a book by Jo Carson, J-O, she's female, was.
Yeah.
Called Stories I Ain't Told Nobody Yet. And they're just magnificent. Absolutely. Of course she's told them, but they're a cross between poetry and short story, but Jo's a Tennessee girl. And she had hearing problems. So she had she had hearing aid for, you know, since she was, you know, not very old.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that was just the most incredible thing, because she could sit at the end of a diner and crank that puppy up and hear what everybody was saying at the other end of the room without their knowing.
You know, I know Jo. She was on our radio show quite a while ago, and she lives where I used to live in California, and I had no idea about any of this. I didn't know she was from Tennessee.
Got
to be a different
Jo
Carson, because Jo Carson is no longer on this plane.
She's deceased now.
Oh, okay.
I think she was in Georgia.
That would have been quite some interview, huh?
Yeah, she was in Tennessee, and then I think she moved to Georgia.
Yeah.
But initially she's Tennessee. Anyway, I'm listening to your voice, and it's making me homesick for Jo.
Yeah, I love Sylvie's Tennessee twang. I love it.
Well, we were such adolescent snots about the South when we were in undergrad, when we were in Conrad is getting his doctorate at Stanford, and we felt awful that the first job was in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we very quickly learned how to grow up past that one. And we did a lot of touring. There is no county in North Carolina where we have not performed.
And wow.
We did an awful, awful lot of touring in that area and have very fond memories.
Now, you're going to be going on tour pretty soon. Is that correct? Do I have that right?
We're going to try.
Yeah. We're
okay.
At the end of this month, we're opening a show called Gifts, and its preview performances actually are in our living room in California.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's designed specifically for house concerts. Lots of people are doing acoustic music as house concerts in people's living rooms and so on. And so we've decided to see what we can do as a theater piece. And so it's about an hour long, and it's three shorter pieces that are connected kind of thematically about aging, change, relationship, gift. It's called Gifts. And so we're doing three performances here, and then we deliberately did not go further booking stuff, because we expect to be doing stuff locally around here and then around California a lot of places that we did the reading of the memoir.
But we want to let it evolve based on what the audience response
is. And then coming back, going back east with it in October. We did an eastern tour of co-creation and had a wonderful time for 3 weeks.
Oh, are you going to be anywhere near northern Tennessee?
Well, that just depends on who invites us and whether we can put it in, you know, to the loop.
Yeah,
because basically,
it's got a living room big enough to accommodate an 8x8
corner
area in one part of it and get 15 friends in, and has 15 friends to invite.
We got that. We got all that. In fact, we
right.
need to do that outdoors.
You
got
to provide us a place to sleep and something to eat, and
they
that's
have
it.
All of that. We have all of that. We'd love to see you here. I'm sure I could get more than 15 people, and
be great
we could
fun.
Even do it outdoors mm-hmm. with the mountain. I have a 180-degree view of the Clinch Mountains in the background.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to do that, I'm serious. You know, think about that.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Well, yeah, that's the basic idea. We have just decided to step completely outside the commercial paradigm. We don't work for pay anymore. We work for gift.
And we'll be doing the same thing with this as we did with our book tour, and that is we'll have books and DVDs of our work to sell. Anybody who wants them?
We can't give those away because
they
cost us money.
We'll have a hat for people to drop
mm-hmm.
things into, because we discovered on that tour that, well, you know, somebody really wants to do something to reciprocate, but
mm-hmm. they don't want to buy the book.
They don't want to buy a $20 book, so okay,
or don't have
the
money.
Here's the hat.
So we did it. We did a little better than 3 weeks of almost a new town every night back last September, and we sold a whole bunch of books, but the hat made out like a bandit.
Wow.
And we did so much better than just pay our gas. It was really interesting.
I hear this from people when they just do things by donation, you know, that they end up with more money than they would have if they charged.
If you search YouTube for how an 8-foot woman is destroying the music industry,
mm-hmm.
you'll get a YouTube of, I think it's a TED Talk, Amanda, and I've forgotten her last name. But she's got a big name. She's been around for quite some time. And mm-hmm. she does a very good job of describing how she came to just say F you to the music industry. And she
mm-hmm.
said it's not a matter of making people pay. It's
mm-hmm.
a matter of allowing them to pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the other side of it is that it is a fact, I think, that it's harder sometimes to get people to come to a free event, because then what's it worth?
Right.
And that's why it
they
has
know
to...
after they see it, but they don't know before. Well, if it's free, it can't be worth much.
And that's why it has
exactly.
to be.
You know, they got to give it away. Jeez.
Right. That's why it has to be in people's homes, instead of in bookstores and theaters. Because in your home, you have your friends. And you've brought these people into your turf. You're not walking onto their turf. You've brought them in as a guest to your house.
Uh-huh.
And it's your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. It's a whole different transaction.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because Tom and I have often said to each other, we've got a great big room here downstairs, and it's like we've often said, boy, it'd be wonderful to stage a play here, but who would come? You know? Well,
you just throw a party.
Yep, we could do that. But it'd be perfect for what y'all want to do.
Sure.
You know what it reminds me of also is the Barter Theater. Have you ever heard of that?
They did one of our plays.
Oh, they did? Which one did
yeah.
they
do?
They did, and I went down
ago.
There to see it.
Oh, well, we're not far from there.
Uh-huh.
The Barter Theater, for our listeners, was established, either during the Depression or sometime before? And during the Depression, a lot of people, because it's a farming community, didn't have the money, the cash. But they had food they'd grown or, you know,
the
pig they'd slaughtered. And so you could, you know, for a ham or something, you could go see a play. And this was a big deal, you know, back in the Depression. There wasn't much around here in the way of entertainment. And so I don't know if they still accept bartering, but
I don't think
there.
They do. I don't think they do. But they're still there, and they're still doing it. And I guess it was about 3-4 years ago, They did a play of ours called Long Shadow that we created for a wonderful theater company that doesn't exist anymore in Nevada City, California, and it was based on a true story, and that is the core of the third novel, the one that we're working on now.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. Recycle.
Yeah.
Reinvent.
So, okay, how can people find you? How can they get in contact with you and all of that stuff?
Our website is a great resource for wasting more of your time than you can possibly imagine. It's independenteye.org.
IndependentEye. IndependenteEye.org, not .com.
And that has a lot of things about our stage work. It has a couple of short video clips. But then you can also go to the media section and listen online for free to any one of 94 of our radio series, which
oh,
we
wow.
had about 2004 to 2007 or something like that.
Earlier than that.
And which is a wonderful collection of real person character interviews and also some very strange audio drama that we do. And look at the print section for our co-creation book.
There's a lot of samples of stuff for free.
And
then that also tells you how to get in touch with us. Our email is the same website. It's just i@independenteye.org.
And then the Realists novel through smashwords.com or amazon.com. Amazon will give you get you the Kindle, and Smashwords will give you
everything else.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, wow. Good luck to you on your new project.
Thank you.
That's really exciting. You two just keep producing stuff. I mean, it's just amazing to me.
Well, what else can you do? I mean, I don't have enough money to just go out and get drunk all the time. I got to do something.
I hear you. It's like that for Green Egg, you know. Tom and I figure we'll be doing Green Egg until, you know, till we drop. I mean, it's like we live out here in the country. It's fabulous. We love it. But we don't even have a movie theater in this little town of 1,400 people. And so...
But you can get online, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're on high speed and everything. We even get TV and, you know...
Yeah, our daughter is a professional translator, the one who lives in the little house in Italy, out in the woods in Tuscany. And she can work from home. She can work with hearing her own little river in the background.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, how fabulous. That's really wonderful. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Sylvie, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, no, I think that they have said it all, and it was wonderful. I'm glad y'all could be on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for reviving Green Egg and making that happen.
Oh, thank you. It's been sheer joy, and I hear you when you say that you don't charge money anymore. It's a whole different ball game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different ballgame, and you can just focus on your art, you know, rather than worry about making money and keeping track of subscribers and all of that kind of thing. So it's been just a real delight, and it just keeps getting more fun.
Yeah.
And Sylvie's our web wizardress and does a great job. So anyway, listeners at home, be looking for, hopefully, sometime soon, Conrad and Elizabeth to be in Tennessee at our house doing a play.
Or any place else.
Or any place else. Yeah, their website's wonderful. I strongly recommend going there. So that's our show for tonight. And our guest next week is S.J. Tucker, pagan singer who has now done a film project. And she'll be telling us about that. Okay?
Okay.
Good night, everyone. Good night.
Night.
Good night, Tom and Aubrey, wherever you are.
You're listening to Air Amarte Fio Radio, your source for the alternative viewpoint to the news around you. In between the amazing shows here, I invite you to check out Rock Soul Radio, the latest source for alternative music and metaphysical talk on the web. Click over to rocksoulradio.com or find us on the Live 365 mobile app by searching Rock Soul Radio.
That's Rockd, R-O-C-K-D, Soul Radio.
We are not going to have Rick Wilson stream the news. Last minute cancellation, personal things, but he will be here next Monday at this time. So we'll see you all then. Good night. You're almost exactly what